Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 197, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Yannick Lederman. We discuss several topics, including ergonomics in the operating room, understanding vitrectomy machine fluidics, and staffing fellows and what you can learn from them. As always, our list of financial disclosures will be listed in the episode description. There will also be a link in the episode description to click on to access the American Academy of Ophthalmology's website to claim CME credits for this and other episodes. Also, as an announcement, we're excited to start a new venture in addition to the podcast. This has always been an audio format, but we'd love to incorporate a video component of our what we do. So starting next month, after our 200th episode, what we're going to start is a YouTube channel, the Retina Podcast Video Club. And what we'll do in those videos is going to be short 5-6 minute videos where we watch videos sent in by you listeners, fellows, attendings out there, and we comment on them and we review them and we learn from them and try to release at least a couple videos a month. So we're opening up to you guys. If you have videos you want us to look at, to talk about, please send them along to retinapodcast@gmail.com. And again, we'll put some exact sort of requirements online. First of all, copyright, as long as there is not an issue with another entity with us reviewing these videos on YouTube, or we can give appropriate copyright, we don't mind. These don't have to be unique videos. So if you've presented them at a meeting or submitted them to another media library, as long as it's okay if we give credit that we use the video for our discussion, we're happy to use it. Second, please keep the videos short, you know, ideally under 2 minutes. Narration is not important, but we love text descriptions to try to tell us what you're doing, and a brief, like, 1 or 2 line description of what the case is. And again, we'll let you know if we decide to feature your video, we'll credit you. And hopefully this will be educational and informative for all of us. And our goal is to kind of watch these videos with me and a couple of our attendings and fellows here at Bascom, kind of go over them. And what I'll do is I'll preview the videos in advance, but the fellow or attending company will not have seen the video before. And so we'll react to it and kind of go through a Q&A and discussion back and forth. It should be a good venture. And again, let us know if you're interested in submitting. Thank you. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be joined by Dr. Yannick Lederman. Dr. Lederman is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology and member of the Vitreoretinal Service at University of Illinois Chicago, Illinois Eye and Ear Infirmary, where he is co-director of the Vitreoretinal Fellowship Program. Yannick, thank you again for joining us.
Jay, it's great to be talking to you today.
It's your first time in the program, and all new guests always get the same question, because we always get interesting, diverse answers. So when and why did you decide you were going to be an ophthalmologist?
I decided during medical school, and I knew I was interested in surgery, and I explored a couple of different surgical subspecialties, including orthopedic surgery, of all things. And ultimately, I think what I decided was I thought microsurgery was a really exciting field, that technology and ophthalmology is something that was really compelling for me. And visual science as a whole, I just felt like was a great complement to surgery and ophthalmology.
And then you decide on ophthalmology. Were you immediately committed to retina? Or what point did you think, okay, I'm going to be a vitreoretinal surgeon for my career and my livelihood?
Yeah, I think at some point during my first year in residency, I realized that vitreoretinal surgery was for me. I think it was a combination of a couple things. One factor maybe was that I had a family member that lost vision to diabetic eye disease when I was relatively young. And I think that probably really made an impression upon me. But also, I realized during residency that we spend more time in the clinic than we do in the OR treating patients. And the breadth of pathology that you see in retina in the clinic, as well as the OR, is something that really interested me more so than other subspecialties. The challenges, the techniques in vitreoretinal surgery, I found to be really, really exciting. I also think to some degree, the fact that, you know, maybe I'm influenced by the fact that my wife is an ER doctor and is able to treat pretty much everything. I like the fact that at least in the OR, vitreoretinal surgery is sort of the most comprehensive of ocular surgery. We don't have as many boundaries where we need to call in somebody else for assistance. And I think that's something that I found appealing as well.
So there's many different components. Let's talk about the OR. I know you teach a lot of fellows, and we're talking a little bit about the course that you put together actually for teaching fellows towards the end of the program. But many different things fellows have to kind of learn when they get in the OR. You know, everything from the foot pedal to positioning. And we're going to go through some of these things right now. But one of the things that I think is really not discussed, and you've talked about before at different forums and settings, is the fluidics and the vitrectomy machines and understanding how the machine works, right? And without bringing in different, and we can give examples of different companies. Again, there's really three major companies in the United States. There's Alcon and Bausch & Lomb and Dorkin each have their own machines with have slight differences in pros and cons and advantages, but they all work fairly similarly. So if you have a new fellow who's fresh out of residency and they show up in your OR, what sort of things would you want them to understand about the machine in brief? So like what sort of fluidics things are important and then relevant and practical in terms of how it changes how you operate?
So that I think is a great question. You know, it's something that I'm very interested in. And you know, the first point I think about is what is really an applied definition of fluidics in vitrectomy. And I think of it as basically all the instrument and machine parameters that affect removal of tissue from the eye during vitrectomy. A lot of people think of fluidics as something that's quite daunting, you know, probably because when you and I say that word, most people think of a chapter they read in a surgical textbook, and it always begins with the treatment of Venturi and peristaltic pumps and the engines that drive fluidics. And while it's useful to understand those things for a sort of deep view of fluidics, the things that I focus on with my fellows or when I give a talk are the parameters I think that we can change during surgery to affect how we perform surgery and make it more efficient. So at some point, you know, I really want to make sure that my fellows understand the concepts of flow and turbulence, cut rate, duty cycle, inflow, outflow, mismatch. Those are probably the most important ones for all of us at some point to grasp during our training. Of all the fluidic parameters that we really control in real time, flow modulation is the most dynamic, right? Everything else requires effectively stopping surgery and changing a setting. So that's one of the first things that I talk to my fellows about. I think new fellows tend to focus a lot more on the position of the vitrectomy probe, which is, of course, really important for safety, but as opposed to modulating flow. A lot of fellows, I think, have two speeds when it comes to the pedal, either slow or fast, right? They're either flooring it or they're not doing very much to be cautious. And so modulating flow, as we can do in a linear way pretty much during vitrectomy, is something that is really important to learn. One of the other things I think that I want my fellows to learn early on is this concept of the attractive force of the small gauge vitrectomy probe. So the analogy that I make, you know, none of the fellows now, of course, are familiar at all with using 20 gauge vitrectomy, but you know, phaco is a relatively high flow system compared to what we do. And I sort of make the analogy to drinking a milkshake, right? You can put the straw in the middle of the glass and pretty much slurp up the entire shake. And ideally in lens surgery, if you're a talented surgeon, the phaco probe isn't moving pretty much. You're moving tissue to the probe. With small gauge vitrectomy, particularly 25 and 27, I like to make the analogy of an ice cream scooper. So the vitreous is filling the vitreous cavity, and you really have to have an acute spatial awareness. I like to tell the fellows, you have to understand where you've been and where you have not been in the eye. And I'm a huge fan for fellows and you know, for new attendings, and I certainly still use it quite a bit myself for visualization agents like Triessence to understand exactly where the vitreous is, because the key is really, if you want to be efficient, you have to move the vitrectomy probe to where the vitreous is and not be passive. So So I think that's one of the first and most important thing that I want the fellows to internalize is those concepts of modulating flow, not just position, and also the attractive force of the instrument and really what that looks like in different consistencies of tissue and moving the probe to take advantage of that. I think the other concept that I talk to the fellows about that probably people think about the least is turbulence. So, you know, intuitively, let's say we have a retinal detachment with really bullous retina. A lot of people's intuition is to use, you know, to control flow by using a little vacuum or flow directly, depending on what type of system you have. And, you know, yes, that certainly will remove less fluid from the vitreous cavity, less infusion coming in, and everything slows down and you have less movement of the retina. But that's often a relatively inefficient way to do a vitrectomy. So one of the things I like to teach fellows in a practical way, and also I think helps understand turbulence, is if you have a detachment, particularly with, you know, a single large break and the retina is really billowing, even before the core vitrectomy, one of the first things I have them do or that I like to do is take all the traction off the break and sometimes excise the flap, and a lot of the subretinal fluid will drain that way as well. And when you do that without that traction, now the retina really flattens and you have much less mobility of the retina, right? Because if it's no longer tented up, all of that infusion fluid flowing in as you're in a high flow state trying to remove a lot of core vitreous, that fluid is now much less likely to flow through the break and to billow up the retina, and you can perform vitrectomy more safely and more efficiently. I think a lot of us just figure that out, right, as experienced surgeons. But if you think of it as trying to minimize turbulent flow in pretty much all situations in the eye where you have something moving around like a bullous retinal detachment, it's always advantageous.
No, that's true. And I think sometimes we, the fellows and people starting, also forget the opposite is true sometimes, right? So if you have a detachment where, for whatever reason, either non-purposefully or purposefully, sometimes people enlarge a break for drainage, for example. If you enlarge a break sufficiently enough for drainage, yes, you'll drain subretinal fluid, but a lot of times, depending on where your infusion is directed, you may actually make the detachment more bullous if your infusion is not directed appropriately. Like sometimes we forget that the infusion is not magical. It's actually pointed in a certain direction. And that's been shown with macular issues. People have shown commotio, for example, from the flow hitting the macula directly. But that's also true of any break. If you have the flow going right towards the break without any sort of, with a straight line, without anything kind of interrupting it, then that can be a problem too.
Yeah, no question. And so, so much of that is also, you know, to dovetail with your point about timing, right? If you've done the entire vitrectomy and you have relatively little retinal motion, but then you're enlarging the break to drain, well, you know, no issue if your next maneuver is going to air or something like that. But I agree with you completely. If you're just sort of deciding, hey, let me make this retinal detachment a little bit more shallow by draining the fluid and enlarging a break that doesn't have a lot of traction, and then you're going to do most of the vitrectomy, you're like, yeah, I agree with you completely. You're just kind of putting an extra hurdle in your way.
You know, sometimes while the fellow is squinting and staring to make sure they get every piece of vitreous, sometimes, you know, you'll take a step back and kind of look at them from the side, and you'll see the neck and the back, and everything is just a mess. And sometimes I find even as the attending assisting, sometimes it can be hard to maintain these good ergonomics if you're switching back and forth. And so ergonomics, I feel we talk about it. I feel like it's not something we don't talk about. I think we talk about it a lot. I just don't know if we employ it a lot in the stress and hustle and bustle of the operating room. Sometimes it's like the first thing that we forget, right? So again, you've shown some great examples where you've taken pictures of people operating. You show this in meetings, but you have somebody who has no bad habits. They're starting from scratch. How do you prevent bad habits? What do you tell them is important when they walk in the operating room to make sure that ergonomically they don't end up in a position where they're, you know, struggling to pick somebody up at age 50 and, you know, or having neck issues in their 50s and 60s?
Yeah, you're so right. One thing I realized along the way is that when you and I train fellows, you know, really nobody is a blank slate, right? Everyone is coming to our OR being a relatively experienced microsurgeon who's completed a you know, 3 years of microsurgical training as an anterior segment surgeon. And in fact, I think where a lot of the bad habits come from is that when you're a third year resident, if you're efficient and you've had excellent mentors, you're probably doing a pretty quick FACO, 15 minutes. And as you get more experience, maybe less than that. So I like to tell my fellows, when they look at some of their mentors, they actually may see some bad habits in terms of ergonomics, because if you're a 6-minute FACO surgeon, well, I like to joke, the fellow and I could stand on our heads for 6 minutes and that would be okay. But I think there's a very different toll that's exacted during a procedure and during a career when you're doing the inherently longer cases that we do as retina surgeons. So I actually think fellows come to us having the opportunity to have maybe picked up, or at least if not picked up, bad habits, not be as mindful of ergonomics and positioning because of the nature of a lot of the inter-segment procedures that they've become really, really fluent in. So what I tell my fellows at the outset of the first OR, or hopefully before the first OR, so we're not slowing down our workflow, is the first thing to pay attention to is something I refer to as right angles. You really want to be seated so that your spine and your hips make about a right angle. You want to take into account the height of the pedals so that your lower leg and your thigh make a right angle. Same thing, at your ankle. One of the things that a lot of people don't do is pay attention to the angle at their elbow. I think a lot of surgeons like to operate, quote unquote, relatively high, meaning they have the height of the eye so that their arm is flexed relative to their elbow and that their wrists are not in a neutral position as well. You and I are both relatively tall, and when you have a long torso, if anything, a lot of scrub nurses are surprised, you're going to want to have the bed relatively low so that your forearm is making a right angle with your upper arm, pretty much parallel with the floor. Your wrists are neutral the same way if you studied piano or other keyboard instruments. You want to be to avoid stress injuries in that way. And then, of course, neck flexion is really key. You mentioned degenerative joint disease and osteoarthritis, and I think we're just now starting to see some data in that in microsurgeons across all fields and in our field as well. And so even if you're using a traditional microscope, I think it's really important to pay attention to try and have your head relatively upright. The design of oculars, to some degree, it's almost impossible not to have some flexion at your neck, but you really don't want to be any more deeply flexed than you need to be. So I really tell the fellows that it is always acceptable, even if we're switching multiple times during a procedure, to take the time, change the height of the bed if necessary, and the microscope, and do all those things to be set up, because I think it has impact not just for career longevity, but certainly to do things like dampen tremor and really make a surgeon more precise by adopting some of those good ergonomic principles.
That's great. I'll be honest. I feel like I'm one of the worst culprits. And I think, again, if we reference, I think it doesn't happen with the immediate beginning of the surgery, but I'm attending like switch back and forth and back and forth. And I think sometimes in the heat of the moment, it's maybe the last switch, we're switching to close or something like that, making sure everything's lined up. But again, all those angles you talked about are super important. I also stretch super aggressively. Usually I stretch most days, but definitely the days of my OR, just because of those fixed positions, I stretch very aggressively because I feel like those are the positions that really need to be kind of ironed, almost like ironing out wrinkles from a shirt. You need to make sure it's all kind of stretched out. So we talked a lot about preparation, theory. Let's end by just talking about complex cases, right? So complex cases when you're a fellow are different than when you're attending, but for fellows and attendings, usually you're thinking of diabetic tractional detachments, proliferative vitreoretinopathy, cases that involve peeling, reattachment, potential hemostasis issues, maybe visibility issues. So how do you, again, I always like to think from the fellow or young attending perspective, good habits come from good mentors. So what are kind of your habits for preparing for complex or difficult cases, potentially difficult cases? And then from a nuts and bolts perspective, what sort of instrumentation do you prefer? How do you like to peel? What do you use to peel? Because everyone does things a little differently, for example, in TRDs. And maybe what you're doing now is different than what you did 5 years ago.
Yeah, so this is such a great thing to talk about, because it's almost like our comprehensive philosophy of how we develop as surgeons and how we prepare for surgery, whether it's complex or not necessarily a complex procedure. So particularly for complex surgery, the way that I think about this is, I guess, the way that we think about a difficult or complex task in any field. we break it down into its simpler component parts, right? I love the outdoors. I love to go backpacking in the backcountry. And, you know, if I'm going to go on an adventure or do something that I've never done before, I sort of think about all the different steps and the things that I need to prepare. So surgery is no different. The two ways that I talk about this with my fellows is thinking about tactical preparation and strategic preparation. So the tactics in surgery are the surgical techniques that we actually employ, and that includes, you know, the instrumentation, but, you know, it's the maneuvers that we are executing in the eye. And in the beginning, obviously, I think a lot of us are still consolidating, you know, which tactics we like to internalize from our mentors and really perfect and make our own. And I think as you get more experienced at this stage of my career, I don't think too much before an individual case about how I'm going to execute, you know, a particular tactic. But I do, you know, one thing that I do like to talk to the fellows about and remind myself is that vitrectomy surgery is very much a team sport, right? So if I'm doing a case that is, you know, in any way different than my usual approach or just something that's not very commonly done, certainly if it's a more than one surgeon case, for example, where I'm doing something with an anterior segment surgeon, in any of those examples or using an instrument that I don't use that often, I think it's really important to have a huddle with the entire team before, including the anesthesiologist, but most specifically the scrub tech, the circulator, basically just to go over the steps and equipment that we'll need. You know, I feel like as a surgeon, you absolutely have no right to be impatient with your team and the fact that instrument X isn't ready if you haven't reviewed with people before that, hey, I'm going to need, you know, this instrument that, you know, I don't use on a routine basis every day. So there's the tactics, but, you know, the part that I still think a lot about before a complex case is the strategic approach. You know, you and I, I'm sure, do a lot of diabetic surgery, given where we practice. You know, TRD for me is pretty much a weekly thing. And in terms of the strategy, what I think a lot about is the patient's visual function as a whole. One of my pet peeves, it really irks me when a fellow is with me, particularly who's, you know, who's going to be performing part or all of the case, is when they're not intimately familiar with, you know, something like the vision in the fellow eye, because this, you know, very much changes not just things like tamponade, but, you know, in many ways how aggressive we're going to be during a particular case, what some of the tactics are that we're going to use. So I think about what is the visual function in the fellow eye, what has been the progression of pathology, especially in something like diabetes, which is often so bilateral. Have they had a surgical procedure in that eye? How did it go? You know, ultimately, what was the outcome? What can we learn with how successful or not it was? You know, psychosocial hurdles. How is the patient going to do in terms of positioning and adherence to post-op regimens and other things? All of those things really influence my strategy before I sit down at a surgery, but certainly during, when I'm making decisions like how aggressive am I going to be, you know, delaminating this area outside the macula in an eye that has no breaks, and the hyoid is still attached, et cetera. All of these things, I feel like the strategic considerations really influence the tactical part of what we're going to do during the surgery.
That's great. And, you know, one thing I'll do just to plug, and I know you didn't ask me to plug it, but I'm going to, if you're a fellow and you're, or an attending, and you're hearing a lot of this and you're like, this is great stuff, this is the sort of thing that, and more, that's covered at this fellows course that you started last year with, in a collaboration with Alcon at their headquarters in Fort Worth. Myself, a bunch of other faculty had the opportunity to come and teach, and it was really, really well set up. So, yeah, like, I just want to give you some time to talk about a little bit about that course and who's eligible. And, you know, this year, I think we're pretty full at this point, though. If someone's really interested, maybe they could reach out and just talk about how you expect it to grow in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate the chance to talk about it. I know it's been fantastic having you as faculty, and we're thrilled that you're returning again this year. You know, I guess in talking about the course, I can mention also some of the tactics in terms of complex surgery to get at the last question. So, for example, in surgery for diabetic tractional retinal detachment, That's something that there are so many different ways that different tactics that each of us like to use because of the complexity of the surgery, right? So I tell my fellows that the strategy is almost always the same, right? You have to get the hyoid off. You have to remove all of the traction in order for the retina to reattach. But you know, some people are really avid bimanual surgeons, lighted pick, lighted forceps, two pairs of forceps, chandelier. There are all of these different methods that people use. For me, in terms of control and efficiency, I've worked hard to really get better and better at using the small gauge vitrectomy probe 25, which is how I do pretty much all of my cases, but sometimes I will use a 27 probe as well. And using fluidics to be able to simulate a vertical scissor, to be able to use the probe like a forceps to delaminate tissues. I would say, most of the TRDs that I do, I can do exclusively just with the cutter. But for the most complex cases, I do like to use a lighted pick. And I use that usually in conjunction with the vit probe as a bimanual way to get off a tenaciously attached hyoid. I'm a big fan of curved lighted lasers in pretty much all diabetic cases, just to be able to get good peripheral laser treatment out there. For PVR cases, I use, I think, a lot more than most people, a chandelier, because I like to depress for myself with one hand and use the cutter in the other. And that's something that actually will be coming out in retina as a technique shortly. If you use 25 gauge Alcon system, you don't need to make another hole in the eye. You can put the chandelier through one of the ports and do pretty much a complete shaved vitrectomy independently, which is, I think, really useful for fellows who train in an environment where you and I teach, and there's always a skilled assistant, but most of our fellows, of course, go out into an environment where they don't have that assistant. So you mentioned the course, and that's something that that I envisioned a couple of years ago and has been great to partner with Alcon, and we have an incredibly talented faculty. I think what differentiates this course from some of the really other excellent ones out there, and I was in some ways hesitant initially to add another fellows course because we have a few really fantastic ones for teaching. But what I wanted to do is have a course that was not really didactic at all, and where we spent almost all of our time in a surgical lab environment. So we use almost exclusively model eyes, although we probably will be doing some VR simulation in coming years as well. But basically, it's very low learner to faculty ratio. We have about 20 phenomenal attendings from all over the country and 40 first-year vitreoretinal fellows, and we spend almost the entire day doing exactly what you were talking about, learning how to do vitrectomy efficiently and how to modulate fluidics by changing machine parameters and how to efficiently do a TRD and learn some techniques for PFO and silicone oil and lighted laser and sort of a lot of the tactics that you just don't see in someone's outstanding 3-minute surgical video that you can get from a lot of meetings with fantastic didactic content. So as you mentioned, it is the weekend before Thanksgiving, November 23rd. At this point, we are fully subscribed and we have a wait list, but particularly for those people out there who are surgical teachers and have fellows, for your first year fellows next year, by all means, please do consider letting them know about the course. It's something I think that we've gotten great feedback on.
Well, Yannick, thank you for all you do. That course, again, was amazing. Almost envious it wasn't available when I was a fellow. And for, again, you mentioned attendings, especially the ones who are the access points for their fellows. If you're a fellow listening, keep it in mind for next year if you weren't able to go this year. And if you're attending, keep it in mind for your fellows next year, or your mentees who may be residents and maybe fellows next year, to give them the heads up and hopefully continue to expand. Yannick, thanks so much for your time. I know you're super busy with AAO approaching and it's a hectic time for everyone. Looking forward to seeing you at the meeting, and safe travels, and I'll see you in a couple days.
Same here, Jay. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me. It's always a lot of fun. And again, thank you for being faculty at the course in November. We're really looking forward to your expert teaching again.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Talk to you later.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINApodcast.com. All 197 episodes, yes, 197 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category We also have our blog, Equal Round Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can claim CME credits for select podcast episodes via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Log in as an AAO member, click on the link in the episode descriptions. Please, again, at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned that we're going to be putting up descriptions of this video submission process for our new YouTube channel, which will be opening after a 200 episode in November. Remember, we're looking for short 2-minute to 3-minute videos max with descriptions. Does not have to have audio, should be edited. And it doesn't have to be a whole case, it can be part of a case, it can be something you're trying to show us. But something interesting, you know, what we'll do is we will watch those videos, react to them, and put our reactions in the video up on YouTube. Does not have to be a unique video. You could have shown it at a meeting before. You could have submitted to another website, for example. But if there is copyright involved, just please make sure that if we, as long as we give credit, such as saying, you know, this video was hosted on the American Academy of Ophthalmology's website, or we can obtain credit, that we won't have issues. We're happy to feature it. Remember, on our website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Store as well as the Android Store. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Store or Android Store. You can email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. That's where you'll send those video submissions. We're on Twitter at retinapodcast, or you can contact us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. We love getting feedback, things we can do better, and things we're already doing well. Again, thank you to everyone who has left positive comments in the form of a review in the Apple Store or Android Store. Many thanks to Dr. Leiterman for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Winnicasa, as always, for everything they do for the podcast and preparing this episode and the accompanying social media. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversation you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.